the product teams, they love to iterate. And what matters to them is deliver the best product possible. But in the go-to-market world, it's all about revenue. And now, by the way, I need stuff now so I can close my deal and I have an imminent deadline. So it's not about perfection, it's about good enough so that they can close their business. And oftentimes, marketing, we are smack right in the middle.
Welcome back to Talking Too Loud, the show that's serving up the loudest takes on building businesses, top-notch products, and unforgettable brands. I'm Chris Savage, the co-founder and CEO of Wistia. And this week, we're talking about something every modern company thinks they're doing, but very few are actually pulling off. That's right. We're talking about aligning go-to-market teams with their product brothers and sisters.
In my brain, it feels like a game of telephone. And it feels like the question that I hope we get into today is really, how does it feel less like telephone? How are we making sure that they're looking at the same data points?
Data. Yeah. Are they looking at the same data? Are they making decisions that are moving the business forward in the right direction? Are they talking the same language? Do they have good vibes? Well,
We need vibes.
We need to be talking the same language. We have to have friendship, actually, as we build these great businesses with strong alignment. And that's why I'm very excited that today we have a special guest, Tiffin Danoquan, who is the Chief Marketing Officer at Amplitude. Tiffin also led marketing at Dropbox, at SAP Ariba, and she's built a reputation for uniting product, marketing, and go-to-market generally around shared outcomes, not just shared meetings.
We are going to get into how she does it. The playbooks, the team dynamics, there's some messy middles, but Tiffin came correct with some hard truths and some blunt tactical takeaways.
Oh, yes, she did.
Don't be scared.
Embrace it. Listen hard. Take notes. This is your moment. And let's do it. Tiffin, so good to see you. Thank you for coming on the show.
I'm so happy to be there with you, Chris and Sylvie.
We're super pumped that you're here and excited to talk to you today. There's a lot going on in the world of marketing. There's a lot changing. What feels different today about getting teams aligned in 2025 compared to where it was like 5 or 10 years ago?
AI. This is it. This is what feels different. And it's exciting. Like that kind of evolution hasn't happened to us in like, what, 20 years?
A long time.
That magnitude. And what I love about this is that it's really sort of putting us on notice to move to a fully data-driven marketing engine. That's what it's doing right now.
Okay, let's go deeper there. What do you mean by moving to a fully data-driven marketing engine?
Like you said, I worked in different companies with different mandates for marketing. And bear with me, I started in 2000, so that was a while ago, right? And this is now, especially over the last couple of years, I'm seeing an acceleration of the mandate of marketing to make data-driven decisions. So being less on the guesswork and the emotional side of marketing, but really ensuring that every single team within marketing, including the creative teams and others, really make data-driven decisions. And I've seen this sharp, sharp shift accelerated with AI.
And so you think that AI is making that happen because like it's harder to stand out, like you have less resources, it is just the expectations of growth are higher. Like which aspects are making us go so far in the data-driven direction?
I think that AI applies to a digital work mostly. Yeah. So there is scrutiny on the digital aspect of marketing inherently because of the AI conversation. So when top leadership is asking for some AI use cases, they are inherently living within digital surfaces, right?
Yeah.
So there's going to be inherently much more scrutiny on those digital engines, surfaces, experiences, and it's going to force the marketer to just go a level deeper into the analysis, the explanation of the experience, and why AI should be either enriching their experience or even at some point replacing some of the key workflows that humans typically do.
Do you think that AI is going to allow us to improve conversion rates?
I mean, if it doesn't, I don't know what we're talking about. It has to be.
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like there's so much changing at once. Like, that's the other big thing. Like, I feel like everybody I talk to feels very busy with really important stuff. You know, we have the shift that's happening in Google from like standard Google results to AI mode, the behavioral shift of people going to AI search and then deep research to find products, to find services, the expectations on teams to move faster. And you're right. I mean, my experience has been similar, which is when you make things all digital, it's much easier to track them. And so therefore, to improve them, you have to get more data driven.
Yeah.
So how do we stay really customer centric in this world with like much more AI and being much more data driven?
That's a great question. And it's at the core of what Amplitude does, actually. To stay customer centric, you need to have really a deep understanding of the customer journey. And the journey is nonlinear, as we all know, as marketers. And the journey is happening a lot more within digital surfaces. And the way you typically look at it is you're going to look at the logged out surfaces of the digital experience. So think website, but also social media, digital social media. And you're going to think about the logged in surfaces. So what we call a digital product, when you are actually into a product, or support sites, community sites, and all of these that require usually a login, a password, an SSO, right? So you're going to have to follow the journey of your users from the moment they discover you, they hear about you, and you're usually in this logged out environment, to the moment they actually jump into a logged in space, right? And for us, it's about connecting those two worlds and make it seamless, because from a user perspective, they don't make a difference. We
do.
They
don't care.
When we analyze, they don't care. For them, it's the same and it should be seamless. But for us, tracking every single step that users are doing, we really have to understand those two worlds really well.
Yeah, I like the way of thinking about that. And it's something that I think about a lot is like, if our customer writes in and we don't get back to them quickly, they don't care that we're on vacation. You know, if they are, using different parts of the product and they feel really different because they're built by teams that are very siloed, the customer doesn't care. They don't know. Like, if from their perspective, they're going about their day trying to get jobs done, and we're just impeding a job being done if we have, you know, failed to do something the way that they expect. And so it is very, very much about breaking that barrier down back to like, what is the best customer experience you can possibly create?
Yeah. And the one that creates value, the one that's differentiated, and ultimately the one that they want more of, because the goal is not just to convert them. The goal is to drive repeat visits, repeat purchases.
Yeah. And you've seen this in so many of the different businesses you've worked in, right? Like you've worked in and led marketing in some incredible companies with like incredible brands, but also ridiculous scale. When you think about that now, is there anything that surprised you in dealing with those huge customer bases? You know, lessons that surprised you, things you took away that you're like, oh, I see the world differently now because of that.
The two common threads that I see with the customers or even the prospects we work with, some of the big pain points they have, one is data, for sure. Data is scattered across the enterprise. They have multiple sources of data. They don't trust data easily. So it's very hard to make data-driven decisions if you don't trust data in the first place.
Or you have bad data, yeah.
Bad data or scattered, siloed data. That's one big one. And the second is the urgency to consolidate tech, you know, the tech stack, right? And especially for CMOs or even product teams or digital teams, is they are being asked to do, it's going to sound cliche, but to do more with less. They have to optimize their budget. They have to optimize the tech stack. And this part is actually a pretty expensive part, right? So when you look at a company and the amount of tech that they have to consolidate across the many departments, it's a lot. So we have to understand those two dimensions, data and tech.
And you get that right, and then things can sing.
When you get that right, you have a competitive advantage immediately.
That's compelling. Let's talk about alignment. So how does alignment work at Amplitude? Like, what are some of the things you've done to help create cross-functional momentum?
That's a great question. We're actually quite maniacal about the alignment. We care about it greatly, and mostly because when you think about the way we work, there is a great product team, which we're very close to. I absolutely adore our CPO, François. He's been a great advocate and a great partner and a great friend. And his team is critical because, first of all, they build amazing products, and our job is to help companies build great products. So
yeah,
as you can imagine, the pressure and the attention is on him a lot. But we partner very closely with our product teams on product launches, of course, but also on product-led growth initiatives. So they have a what we call the growth product team that works closely with my growth marketing team. And remember, logged in and logged out, what I was mentioning? That's what we do. We reconcile the two worlds. The growth product team optimizes what's in the product, and the growth marketing teams does everything possible to bring the people in the product. So we reconcile those two worlds really well. And to do this, we need a single data set, and we need to use a single platform to actually follow the data of the users from logged in experiences and surfaces, website and others, all the way to the product.
What have been the most surprising learnings you found as you've brought that connection together? Because obviously so many people don't, they treat them as separate. And exactly as you're talking about is the problem, right? Like they have the marketing data and they have their product data and they don't actually connect. So when you connect them, I have to believe you've seen really interesting things. Have you seen anything really surprising when you did that?
Yes. First of all, when teams really want to work together, that's the first thing. You gotta wanna, as we say, you gotta want to work together. So that's the first piece. Nothing happens unless the teams actually want to work together and start sharing insights. So once you start sharing insights and get on calls and conversations literally on a weekly basis, that's when you start to uncover things that may surprise you. One of the things that we very quickly discovered was that our onboarding flow and setup flow was something we needed to optimize. So that was something we immediately called to the attention of leadership. And that was a very clear mandate for the team. So what surprised me is, in a positive way, is the eagerness of the teams to work together, identify pain points. One could be onboarding flows, and it's not uncommon, and just go and attack the problem together, right? So the nice surprise is that willingness, that eagerness to work on it. And because I think François and I have really worked very hard to drive this sort of shared mindset, shared goal, we really want the teams to succeed. So we do everything we can to give them the environment for them to work well together, have shared goals, and unlock, I would say, progress based on common issues that they can detect together.
Awesome. And that makes sense, like shared goals, shared plan, mm-hmm. shared data. And I also want to dig in here. Maybe this is just like my pet project, but one of the things I've learned is, like, you said you're friends with Francois. And one of the things I've learned over time is, like, when the team feels like people are actually friends with each other, when they're working together, there's like magic happens. Like, there's this level of trust that exists where suddenly they push back on the little thing they might not have pushed back on. Like, the search of truth is much easier. Have you had a similar experience? Is that what things are like for you all over there?
1,000%. And, you know, I started to realize the power of that friendship between product and marketing a couple of years ago when I was at SAP Ariba. Actually, I had a fairly dramatic experience because I was hired to actually fix the friction points between the product team and the marketing team at the time. And at the time, I had zero experience with that friction point because this is not what I had I had seen before. I came in within 1 week of me starting the Certifin, there is dramatic friction between the two teams. You got to find a way to make it work because in 2 months from now, we need to show 12 product innovations on stage and we have nothing. That was that dramatic.
Oh my gosh.
That is very dramatic.
So I literally moved myself to the building where the product team was. And within 2 months, I think we worked tirelessly. We worked on weekends. We came back. We built 150 different assets. But we knew we had one mandate, which is we need to launch those innovations. We need everybody to be equipped. And because I was an outsider coming in, I had no baggage. So they offered to start again the relationship. And I was empowered at the time by my boss and the CMO of SAP at the time to just take control and just really drive project manage the teams to get this done. And the power, what it changed fundamentally is the team dynamics. For the first time, the teams had an ability to get things structured, organized. It was a team effort. We would co-present the plans. And we had a hugely successful launch of those innovations. And a year later, the company grew by 30%. So there is tangible impact when the teams are actually working well together. Beyond the emotional friction and whatever, it really drives top line.
Yeah, I love that. And yeah, it is one of those things people talk about culture. They talk about vibes. they talk about friendship. And I feel like it's all this soft stuff that is actually really, really matters, right? It's like, if you're in there for 2 months and everyone's fighting with each other, it seems pretty obvious you're not gonna solve the problems if they're actually, and that's the extreme version. But I think a lot about like the border of how do you get someone from kind of caring to really caring? Like, how do you get someone to go from they don't need to do this extra work to like push something to be great, but they actually do? And like, what does it take to go from good to great? And obviously people have written books on this. But that team dynamic and also that alignment, right, is so important. The other thing I think about is like actually having really clear goals so that if you have these things fitting together, that's when it starts to work.
So clear goal is important, but here's also a good one, I think, to think about is when you have a deadline, the deadline becomes your forcing function.
Yeah.
So if you are very deadline focused, I'm extremely linear and I like deadlines for that reason, you focus the team on that. And you tell them, set aside everything that happened before, that doesn't matter. We have a deadline. We have an objective and we need to meet that deadline no matter what. Are you game? Yes or no? And once they say yes, then you get rolling, right? But the deadline becomes the forcing function. I love it. I use it all the time, by the way. When I see conflict or friction with teams, I'm like, it's all great and said, however, we have a deadline and we need to get the job done. And that immediately, I would say, neutralizes the conversation because the teams have a common objective.
What do you do if you don't have a deadline?
I create one.
There you go.
You make the deadline.
That's the trick. And it's funny because my boss is exactly like that. He's also Danish. So we are both from Europe and very linear people. But this is it. Each time we have to create deadlines for teams and it works.
That's really interesting. I mean, it's interesting. I was trying to picture the people who are like, I don't believe in deadlines. And like, that doesn't make sense. And
But here's the point. Yeah. If you don't mind, we can talk about this a little bit because a lot of people ask me about the difference in culture between go-to-market and product and how to work. And I put a lot of thoughts on it. You know, the product teams, they love to iterate. And what matters to them is deliver the best product possible. And they are often also KPI'd on user retention, as we know. But their mindset is, I'll keep iterating until I have an MVP, right? And they are a little bit more longer term focused for that reason. For them, it's the quality of the product that matters.
Yeah.
And they have a personal attachment to that product. And I understand that because, remember, I moved myself to the building. So I was with them long nights on weekends, and I saw their dedication to perfection. That's what they want. But in the go-to-market world, it's all about revenue. And now, by the way, I need stuff now so I can close my deal and I have an imminent deadline. So it's almost the opposite. For them, it's not about perfection. It's about good enough so that they can close their business, right? And oftentimes, marketing, we are smack right in the middle. We have long-term thinkers who think about perfecting their product. And we have short-term thinkers who think about driving revenue. And by the way, if they don't, they're out the door. And it's usually quite brutal. As we all know, in B2B SaaS, if you miss your number, your quarter, you're out. So that's where I think there's a good tension. And the best marketers in the world, they know how to work across those two dimensions and create an environment that sort of navigates across those two dimensions.
How do you operationalize that for marketers? So if on the product side, they're constantly iterating, they're moving towards making the best quality product they can, they have a long-term view, and they like that way of working, then what does that mean for how you operationalize and how you work on the marketing team? Is it the same style? Is it different? Obviously, it's a different urgency, but
we have to, first of all, there has to be some extremely regular checkpoints and feedback loops. So that's the first thing to operationalize and just make sure that you have very regular meetings, that you have business reviews on a regular basis. So to me, it's like non-negotiable. You have to have that. The one thing that we like to say to the product team that I apply also in my team and is very hard is you have to carve out some time in your quarterly execution plan for the inevitable last minute surprise. And sometimes that's hard, right? That's hard for marketing because we are very organized. We have plans. We have, you know, a way of doing things. And then, of course, the sales team is going to come and they're going to say, oh, we need this last minute thing. And it always comes as a disruption. And for the product teams, that's even more. The sales team is going to say, I need you to build this extra feature that was not planned in the roadmap. And that is incredibly disruptive. So
totally. Yeah.
What we need to do as marketers or even as product teams, because both our teams are actually service oriented. We build products. We build campaigns, we build materials for sales. If you go and work with the sales team and we need to allow them to close the deal, right? So you gotta have to be ready mentally to make room for the unexpected is the way to do it. And then a certain percentage of your time that's gonna have to be flexible enough to anticipate that unexpected and very quickly pivot to the unexpected. So of course it's hard, but over time you sort of know it's going to come. you almost can predict exactly when and what time of the year it's going to come. So that is when you work with a sales-led sort of engine. And then on the product-led growth side, which is more of a run rate business, where you don't have that sort of mindset in a way, you have to be very much into the data all the time to sort of adjust and anticipate what could go wrong. So, for example, you're gonna look at your product-led growth revenue, and you're gonna have to constantly anticipate what could go wrong. Like, no matter what your model is gonna tell you, that you think your run rate is gonna go, and based on historical data, you're gonna be able to achieve X of revenue or anticipate X of churn, something's gonna go wrong. Something you haven't thought about that's new, you didn't. So the teams have to develop that flexible muscle. They have to figure it out.
Yeah.
And you know what the best way is to figure it out? Teamwork. When the teams know, oh, we have a problem, and then you're going to have to help each other and figure it out. So if you don't have that trust, you don't have that teamwork.
I know you ship a lot of stuff. So you're shipping quickly. Mm-hmm. You're iterating and changing a lot. Mm-hmm. Very similar to us. We're shipping like crazy. And that's amazing. Like, this is a very good input, is to ship in a product-led growth business, is to ship better product, put more improvements out the door, try more things and go to market. But also, to your point, when you're shipping a lot of stuff, it can be, you don't always know what's going to happen. So you sometimes people make tiny changes that they think are innocuous and have big impacts. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like when you see that across the whole business, the answer is like the teamwork to dig it. It's like, that's going to happen. That's normal. You're gonna break some things as you move forward. So the most important thing is actually, how do I make sure that the team is in a really solid place, that people actually address these things, solve them quickly? Is that how you think? Am I reading you right?
Yeah. So there is a reasonable amount of experimentation that you need to allow the teams to do. Like, you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs, and you have to allow them to fail. It's part of the experimental process, and you have to give them the ability to do it, but not necessarily at the expense of their targets, though. It's just, you need to carve out time. That's what I call the unexpected, right? The experiment. Yeah. You're going to allow them to do it, but you have to also hold them accountable to the number and the target that they have to deliver. So it means that your culture needs to be a high-performing culture that is also set up for them to be held accountable. And we had to drive that at Amplitude as well, right? It's great to have room for experimentation and iteration up to a moment where you are still held accountable for your targets. So don't forget, like, we all have to just really run the business and be held accountable. So the toughest part is, like, how much room do you have, right, to let your teams fail, iterate quickly, while still holding them accountable to the number. And all I can tell you is that it comes with a little bit of experience. It's you figure out after a while that, you know, that room may vary from quarter to quarter, depending on the resources that you have, the targets that you have, the budget that you have. It's not linear. Sometimes you're very tight, and my team goes back and says, Tiffin, we don't have a lot of time to diversify as channels as much as we could because we are very tight on budget. And I'm like, that's fine. Let's acknowledge that. We know. And hopefully next quarter we'll have more room to do it. But make no mistake, we're very accountable to the targets and the overall number that we have to deliver.
When you look to, let's say, 2026, what do you think are the right inputs that marketers need to focus on? So we know what the right outputs are, the right outcomes, more customers, more revenue. But what do you think are the right inputs that people should be thinking about today?
There's only one: net ARR. And I mean it, because sometimes marketing is very focused on delivering pipeline and new logos and all of it. But the reality is that equation is really rapidly changing. A lot of companies, especially in the B2B SaaS, are facing churn. So the actual only equation that matters today for people who are accountable for a number is to be held accountable to a net number. It doesn't matter how great you are at delivering pipeline. If there is no action taken from the teams to manage churn and that impacts your net ARR, this can be terminal for a public company, right? So there's no other option right now but ask all the teams to contribute to a net ARR number. And that to me is, I think, one of the fundamental equations that's going to move across the industry. It's not enough to ask marketing to just really drive pipeline, new ARR, new revenue. You got to have to also support the business on churn and retention objectives. And I think to me, this is one of the big changes I've observed in marketing, and where actually the partnership with the product team matters because their primary KPI is actually retention.
Yeah, that is a huge change. That is a very, very different change. And when you think about that, the role for marketers in that, like what should people take away? What should they take back? Okay, so they're looking net ARR, thinking about getting new customers, but also retaining the existing ones, looking across those for like what has the most impact. What should they take back to their teams and say, hey, like, this is why marketing should be so involved in product now. And this is why we should be talking to customers in a different way than we were before.
Well, if you look at the net ARR equation, it's new logos minus churn equals net, right? And if you want to increase your net, you either drive new logos, new pipeline, new lands, and, you know, or expand, or you work on the churn number. You mitigate churn. And to mitigate churn, you either run on the marketing side, you can run a lot of lifecycle initiatives, right? But you have to work with the product team to make sure that they really focus on user retention. There is a direct correlation between usage and retention. If your usage goes up and you have an ability to just really drive compounded usage and value over time, you immediately see a reduction in churn. So you have those levers available. Are you going to drive land and expand, or are you going to mitigate churn and drive retention? So it's really a matter of doing this. If for example, the company says, we really have some churn challenge, we have long tail churn that we need to fix, so we have an onboarding problem in our product, that puts the emphasis on that part of the equation. And of course, marketing is going to have to figure it out with the product team. So it's a math situation. How much do we put on acquisition, land, expansion? How much do we put on working on user retention, which puts also a lot of efforts with post-sales teams and the renewals teams and the product teams? That, to me, is the equation every single CMO needs to figure out.
And so it's back to what you're saying at the beginning about why everything's so data driven, right? You're talking about there's a lot of math you need to do.
Yes.
Put it together and understand what's going to move the needle. Is it reducing churn? Is it getting new logos? Is it getting the average order of customer up for new logos? And you also said something else interesting in there, and I want to dig in one level deeper on this, and then we'll pull back up to close the interview. But you talked about the driving usage to basically drive adoption and then thus reduce churn. Mm-hmm. How do you think about pricing in regards to usage and the idea that there's like, you know, you should look for a value metric that correlates with value for your business. But if you have a value metric which correlates with value, often if you're charging for it enough, then you're going to change behavior and decrease it. So how do you think of that interplay of pricing and usage together? I know this is a big one, but I thought I heard something in there, so I wanted to dig in.
So typically when you, let's just say, you work in a company that has a PLG engine, so you could have a free offering, then you start having online credit card offerings, and then you have sales plans, right? Enterprise plans, which is the case, by the way, for for Amplitude. The one thing we have to consistently monitor is what we call the PLG flywheel. What is a PLG flywheel? Is moving your users, your customers from plans to plans as they grow and as they mature as a company. So they could start with a startup plan or a free plan. They're going to upgrade themselves to a limited online self-serve product-led growth plan. And then over time, your goal is to upgrade them to an enterprise plan, right? So we have to constantly monitor that PLG flywheel, and that's completely dependent on our pricing and packaging and licensing, right? So if you don't have the right pricing, packaging, and licensing, I guarantee you that flywheel is not going to happen. People will downgrade, or you will not have a predictable flywheel engine. So this one is critical, and it's hard to do. Let me just say this, right? It's in every company I've been, having what we call PPL, pricing, packaging, and licensing right, is really challenging. It should be prioritized. It's not just a marketing mandate. Sometimes the finance team owns that strategy, which is the case at Amplitude. But sometimes it can be marketing or other go-to-market functions. But it's critical for that reason, right? And a customer is going to have a maturity curve in their lifetime. So you have to very thoroughly think about the components of the pricing so that you consistently add value as they grow and as you incentivize them to buy more. So if you don't get that pricing right off the bat, you are creating a lot of problems for yourself.
Well, thank you for answering that, because that was a great answer. You're also saying there, you want to match your pricing to the customer maturity curve. So if someone comes in, they're just getting started, they're not going to need that much. But whatever the core value of whatever you deliver is, they should be able to do that and do more of it. Would you say a simple way of saying this is you want whatever that core usage that they're getting value for that's in there, that like that should correlate with growth to some degree, but you have to have enough that people can really use the product.
That you have sense. To have 100%.
I might be getting too abstract here, but
no. You have to have enough, of course, to justify them upgrading and paying for more. Of course, you have to find the right balance between how much they're ready to spend for how much they're ready to get. Right. And then, of course, there's going to be an expectation from them that if they keep on spending more and paying more, they get inherently more value, more usage, more seats, more events or available users as they grow. So you always have to find that sort of curve in your pricing model to find a balance between the right price and the right value. And that's what's really hard to do, actually.
Yeah, it's hard to do, but also it's something that I think you have to do looking at everything that you talked about on the customer journey, right? From like someone hitting the website, not knowing what it is you do, to signing up for a free plan, to eventually being able to expand on the enterprise side. And I think about it as that combination of marketing and product, where the price is part of the product to a degree, right? Like if I have a MacBook and I make a MacBook and it's a $100 MacBook, I've just made the greatest computer of all time. And if I make it a $10,000 MacBook, it might be the worst. Yeah. And so it's the same MacBook, but very different based on the perspective.
Yeah. And one of the things where I think product and marketing can really have the same language is optimizing conversion rates. So it's a conversion game, right? You have to make sure that everything you do converts all the way down to close one, as we know. If you dissect the journey and there is a conversion point that doesn't work, sometimes that conversion is owned and managed by product teams. Sometimes it's owned and managed by marketers. Sometimes it's owned and managed by sales teams or renewals teams. You focus there, right? And the pricing should be an enabler to allow for greater conversions, faster conversions. That's it.
Super simple. Makes sense.
Of course it's simple, but no, I'm kidding. No, it's not. It's not simple. I think if you can, we rationalize it by monitoring the conversions and ensuring we do it. What's hard is finding the secret sauce so that your conversions are getting bigger and faster.
Where do you think marketing and AI, it's going more data driven, but like, is there anything that you think people will be really surprised to see in the next few years from B2B companies that are doing great marketing?
What I keep hearing and saying to the team is that the surprise will be how fast this is going to disrupt us. It's not a 27 conversation. It's a now conversation. If we don't invest now, it's going to move so fast in the next 6 to 9 months that it's going to be really dramatic. So what I say to my teams even now as we are planning for 2026 is like, be ready. Have the mindset to know you're going to be disrupted. Your org, your workflows are going to be disrupted. The website's going to be disrupted. Everything will be disrupted. So be in the mindset of accepting that reality and work the problem to find a solution. So in my view, every marketing leader should have some AI level of reasoning as part of their planning process. The one that I'm doing with my team right now is how do we anticipate some of the key workflows by function to be either enriched by AI or replaced by AI? That to me is a fundamental question.
Well, I think that's a perfect place to end. The big questions for everybody to ask themselves. Super interesting episode. I think people are going to learn a lot. Tiffin, where can people connect with you to learn more about you and Amplitude?
You can email me, tiffin@amplitude.com. I'll be happy to take your questions, your inquiries. You can find me on LinkedIn. I'm Tiffin Danaquan, or you can find us, Amplitude, on LinkedIn. That's the place to be. And of course, you can visit us at amplitude.com.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You know, I love it when you have a really senior leader who is also really in the details and knows all the things about how the teams are working together, how to create shared alignment. I love that. I thought the deadline piece was really interesting. I'd never heard someone talk about deadlines as creating alignment to work through an issue. Like often it feels like deadlines are going to create issues. Mm-hmm. And in this example of like, hey, if we have this shared, you know, this shared mountain we want to climb, and we have to get it done before the storm comes in, then we better cut our BS and make sure who has the right supplies, who has the lights, and who has the tents.
Yeah, that was the perfect analogy. I see it. I see it. I see the mountain. I see the storm rolling in. I think the other thing that stood out to me is also like when she was talking about planting herself, like, in the product team when she was just like, I'm going to move my whole setup there and really learn to speak their language. Yeah. And it makes so much sense that product and marketing would be in lockstep, but I can also see how hard it is to stay that way, especially when she was saying like product is long-term thinking, marketing go-to-market is kind of like right now we got to sell. And bridging that gap is like a delicate dance, but she's dancing.
Yeah. And I agree. And I think that specific example was one of those ones of, there's a real lesson in that of, you know, if you don't know why something is happening the way that it is, or there's a problem, like sticking yourself to it, get very, very, very close to it, like literally sitting around the people. It's amazing how rapidly you can get the right information to actually solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, this was a great one. To all you out there who are listening and watching, we love you. So
wow.
Keep on doing what you do. No, that was too strong a word.
You went
we like
full
you.
L. Oh God, okay.
To everyone out there, thanks for listening. We'll see you soon. Don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you consume the show. All right, bye-bye.
Talking Too Loud is brought to you by Wistia, hosted by Chris Savage, produced by me, Sylvie Lubow, along with Adam Day. Executive produced by Wistia Studios. This episode was mixed by Maria Passingham of Edit Audio. Listen to Talking Too Loud wherever you listen to podcasts. And hey, rate and review us wherever you listen. And check out more content from Wistia Studios at wistia.com.